Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for staying until the very end, or not really the very end, until the late afternoon. I'm promising that it will not be boring. At least we will do what we can. This is about the future of European growth policies. Let me shortly introduce the panelists. At my left, at the very end, you find Laszlo Andor. He served as EU Commissioner for Employment, Social Affairs and Inclusion from 2010 to 2014. He's currently a Mercator Senior Fellow at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin and Senior Research Fellow at the Hans-Böckler Stiftung in Düsseldorf. I hope I got that right. Erik Berglöf, to my right, is Professor of Economics and Director of the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics. Next is Nauro Campos, he's sitting next to me. He's a professor at Brunel University, London, in the UK, where he teaches in the Department of Economics and Finance. Daniel Gross is director of the Brussels-based Center for European Policy Studies. You remember from what I said this morning, he is a joint editor of InterEconomics. CEPS is our partner, and we very much appreciate this cooperation. Deborah Revoltella is director of the Economics Division at the European Investment Bank. I would like to start with a simple question. The panelists have about 5 minutes to give their opinion on it, and then we will start and hear what you're going to say. My question is, if you were in charge, what would be the first most important thing you would do to promote growth in Europe? And I'd like Laszlo Andor to start.
Thank you much. There is no more challenging question than this, especially for a former official and a former decision maker. After all these years when we were looking for the best ways to promote growth and get the European economy out of the double recession. Because of this reason and because of this experience, what I would like to identify as a key issue is to sort out the monetary union. If you want to be a bit more explicit, to redesign the monetary union. I think we discussed in the various workshops in the afternoon and also in the morning many of the short-term but also the longer-term growth issues, difficulties, are somehow related to the specific design of the EMU. What I was stressing, and I would like to just repeat here, is the lack of a proper recovery capacity, the lack of a macroeconomic framework which would allow for a robust countercyclical policy, whether it is the management of demand or whether it is the management of investment. Some of the policies which are needed in this context have been promoted, have been identified, have been tried, have been marketed, but nothing properly has been implemented, partly because, I would say also in economics, Europe is lacking a unifying narrative. And this is very important, I think, to get together for this exercise and discuss what is the purpose of the monetary union. You cannot just see it as a technical instrument. It needs to serve some broader purpose of the EU, and we need to check the experience we have behind us against these requirements and objectives. Some good ideas have been already at least partly implemented. I believe, for example, that supplementing the fiscal rules with a macroeconomic imbalances procedure has been a step forward. Introducing banking regulation for the Eurozone as a whole have been a step forward. But we have to ask again also on these questions why the results are partial, why the implementation is partial, why, for example, it's always much easier to put pressure on deficit countries than surplus countries, and why we remain in this cycle that if a deficit country is in trouble, the recipe is internal devaluation. When surplus countries accumulate more and more surpluses, not much can be done, and then we suffer this permanent lack of demand, and the way out is not clearly identified. We appreciated, and I'm sure colleagues will speak about this, the Juncker plan, which eventually came to promote investment. But again, this also needs to be reviewed collectively, how to boost it and how to use it also to address the imbalances and not just kind of general deficit of investment.
Thank you very much. May I ask Erik Berglöf to give his opinion?
Okay, so I may be a little bit less ambitious than changing the monetary union, but I think effectively we are talking about the same thing. So I would look at, so I don't think there's just one thing that can be done, but I would look at particularly the financial sector, and I think there are some short-term issues and there are some sort of long-term issues. And I think in the financial sector, clearly we still haven't dealt fully with the crisis in Europe in the banking sector. That needs to be done, and it's, of course, it varies a lot from country to country and from institution to institution. But that, I think, is absolutely critical to get growth going, and then also to get particularly small and medium-sized enterprises to get access to funding. So that's a sort of short-term, a sort of leftover from the crisis. But of course, the sort of more important legacy from the crisis is the whole sort of superstructure that we have in the financial sector, and we have made a tremendous progress in terms of the banking union, but there are still large gaps, and they, I think, absolutely needs to be addressed. And I know this is not something that's going to happen soon, and it's not some of the things that have to be done are not very popular in this country. But I really think that, on for example, on the resolution side, I don't think there is a sense that anyone wants to test the system the way it is today. So I, institutions and policymakers are not confident that it will stand up to a serious test. And I think that's something we really have to do something about. I don't think also, and I think it's related, you need to find a different structure to the European financial system in the long term. You need to find a better balance between markets and banks. You need to find also maybe more creative arrangements in terms of development finance. So the Juncker plan was mentioned. I think it is an innovative arrangement, and I that has probably not also been tested. Maybe Deborah can say more about that. But I think that's the right way to think about how we can mobilize resources. And in particular, I think we should think about models for how to crowd in private finance into these arrangements. When I was at the EBRD, we worked on a very interesting model that I think the way it came out has is not as powerful as it could be. And it was a model where we tried to use these governance structures and these project assessment capacity of the EBRD and allow institutional investors to come in into that structure. So basically, institutional investors who would never basically go to emerging economies, certainly not the ones that we were working in, they could rely on this mechanism for assessing projects, on the governance mechanism and so on institutions like EBRD or EIB, and that would be a way to really channel serious money into both into development but also into infrastructure and into other things that will help growth in the long term. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Nauro Campos. from Portugal.
Well, thank you very much. Again, I mean, happy birthday to InterEconomics. It's indeed a major achievement. The question was faced. It's a very important and very interesting one. It's where would I lay the focus of growth policy? And I would like to start by, I'll talk about my papers in the second half of my answer, but in the first part, I'd like to talk about a paper by, it's one of those things that I read, and I said, well, I wish I had written that. It's a paper by Eric Bartelsmann from the Free University of Amsterdam that was just published, finally, in International Economic Review last month. And it's a very important paper to this discussion because he essentially examines what are the policy strategies to close the productivity gap between the U.S. and Europe. And he goes back to the seminal paper by Blanchard and Wolfers and recognizes this basic trade-off between institutions and technology. I mean, Eric had a very long discussion about technology today. And what Eric Bartelsmann does is essentially says, well, I mean, it's not about either institutions or technology, but I mean, what has to be at the center of a growth strategy is the interaction between the two. And I will, because Eric covered the technology, I'll talk about institutions. And within institutions, I think that today, I mean, have done a lot of progress. And what I think, if I have to answer this question with one word, I would say integration. And I think that's where the focus of growth policy should be. And I will use the five presidents report, and I would say it has to be, to qualify my answer, and I think it should be deep, genuine, and fair integration. I mean, that is, I think, the features of a growth policy that will take us out of the crisis. I'm not going to be talking about genuine and fair, because my two speakers to my left covered these topics today, but I'll talk about deep integration a little bit, just to give a bit more content to my answer. And now I'll talk about my papers. And I'll give you three examples of three reasons on why deep integration should occupy center stage in a growth strategy for Europe. And I would like to do that by looking at the three interesting historical experience of enlargement. And the first one is the 1973 enlargement. The 1973 enlargement can be looked at a number of different ways, but one of the most interesting one is the victory, the definitive victory, one can say, of the customs union model over the free trade model. And this is, in Balassa's grand scheme of things, represents deeper integration. In a number of exercises, we've been looking at what are the consequences of this change, and we have estimated the result I would like to bring up here. We have estimated the returns, I mean, the benefits of deepening integration in this context. And we found not only that they are substantial in terms of per capita GDP, but one feature of deep integration that is incredibly important is that they are even more, if not bigger, much more robust and much more sustainable in terms of total factor productivity. I mean, that, applies to the United Kingdom. I mean, we have results showing that the accession of the UK to EU had substantial effects on the level of per capita GDP. It didn't help the UK to take off, but it did help the UK to land and to freeze the gap between the level of per capita GDP between the UK and the six founding members. This result contrasts radically with results in terms of productivity, in which you do observe a much, much more clear tipping point, turning point, structural break on the ratios of the U6. The other two examples I'd like to bring to your attention that illustrate that, I mean, how limitless deepening integration can be is from the 1995 enlargement. I'm a bit worried to have Eric here, because I mean, that is the Scandinavian enlargement, of course. But we have a wonderful and unique discontinuity there, if you want to understand what is the impact of deep integration. And that unique discontinuity is that we have four countries that were ready to join, but one, in the very, very last minute, actually a month and a half before the date of accession, that's Norway, decided not to. Then we have a situation in which we have three countries that experience deep integration, i.e., European Union plus EEA membership, and one country that experiences only one of these two features, which is EEA, which is essentially purely economic and not political integration. I mean, we have, using regional data for Norway and the other three countries, we have generated counterfactual simulations for the regions of Norway, and we estimate that this decision generated a productivity loss of 6% in the first 5 years. Between 1995 and 2001, productivity in Norway would be 6% higher if it had opted for a deep integration route. If you're worried about 6% being high or low or significant or insubstantial, I mean, the whole debate about the UK productivity puzzle today is essentially about 6% in 5 years. And the third and last example, if I may, again from a different enlargement, we look at the progress report that the Commission prepared for the 2004 enlargement. And what one can get from them is a very detailed picture of institutional building and of increasing state capacity. Then we quantified, I mean, all the reports, and we examine, we ask whether or not deep integration increase or decrease state capacity, and we find massive, massive increases. I mean, we do, of course, also use this exercise to estimate optimal implementation sequences, but that's clearly not the point here. But we do observe very, very large institutional gains in terms of institutional development from deep integration. And in the context of this exercise, we found, presenting the work in Norway, for example, a couple of weeks ago, and in the UK, that even for very rich countries, I mean, this process of deep integration can easily, one can observe institutional improvements by, you know, sharing policy practices. And one particular example that keeps coming up is the implementation of competition policy. The bottom line is essentially of my answer is, I think, until Brexit, we academic economists at least took for granted that integration was good. We didn't have paper after paper states in the abstract that the estimates are not robust. And I think that if you have to find a bright light in the Brexit issue, maybe this accumulation of this new evidence really shoring up these gains from deep integration is probably one of the few things that are welcome development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Daniel Gross.
Yeah, thanks a lot, and also happy anniversary, double round anniversary. 50 and 100 years. I think there's something you can be proud of. On growth strategy, I think that always has two elements. One is better utilization of the existing factors of production, and the other is productivity. On utilizing the factors of production, I think we're making actually good progress on labor, because the labor force participation rates have actually increased nicely throughout the recession. That cannot go on forever. There's still some room there. And since it is going so well, I wouldn't change anything for the time being and just hope that this process continues. But of course, this has a limit. And then we know that the demographics will turn against us. I mean, the labor force, or the potential labor force, people in the bracket 15 to 65, from 2015 onwards, or from last year, they will start to diminish in the EU area by 0.5% per annum. And there's nothing we can do about that, right? not for the next 20 years. And migration is just too small to count. So that we have to take as the beginning. So we should not aim at something in the past. All we can do is about productivity. If you want to increase growth, we have to increase productivity. Now, and here, if you're honest, we don't have very strong, instruments. I have yet to find somebody who can show me, you push this button and productivity growth will increase by 0.5% per annum. I think, is very difficult to achieve. And we face a problem. If you want a bit the opposite of what you are saying, if I take people in, the EU 15, and I tell them, yes, we need more integration, we need more structural reforms, and we need more education, right? And that will give us more growth. These are exactly the three instruments which were used over the last 15, 20 years. And this is also the period when productivity growth has gone down. So I think we have a problem here, at least with expectation management. Why? How can we tell people we need more of the same and something which hasn't worked in the past? How can we make it credible that this time will be different? And I think that is, for me, the main challenge. Maybe we'll say later something about investment after Deborah has advertised it. But anyway, investment can only mean higher capital stocks, so not a higher steady state rate of growth, but a higher level of growth with decreasing returns to scale. And I didn't want to spoil your pitch, but we have to keep in mind that already right now, the capital to output ratio in the EU is much worse than that of the United States. And I'm not sure that more investment will improve that. But let me repeat, for me the main challenge is, can we actually tell people that the things which we have emphasized in the past will now suddenly work much better?
Deborah Revoltella. Last.
It's difficult to enter immediately after that in order to have a radically different view. But actually, I fully share what you say. So I think it's a really productivity the thing that we have to work. And for me, the point is that you can try to do investment and a certain kind of reforms that all together contribute also not only to the capital stock, but can have an impact also on productivity. And that's the way in which I see it. So it's not like a massive plan of investment, but try to target investment in areas where you may have some loop then going also toward productivity. But in terms of, and I also add one point on the policies that you were mentioning. Are we really sure that we were serious in the last 20 years where we were doing the policies on for affecting productivity? Or we were just talking and not doing much? Because that may be the difference, the fact that we have talked so much about doing something, but in reality we were not doing. And that could be the difference if at a certain point we become serious in doing it. But we have to prove that we can become serious in doing it. But this was a quick answer. But then if I have to tell what is the policy, I think I start from a small point, that is, what is the EU political reality in this moment? Because I think it's important to tell that than to say what kind of policies we have in front of us. And I think that after the Bratislava summit, we have a clear idea that the political debate will advance with very much tactical move in a few files that are shared by the politicians in the different member states, and are shared because the advantage, they are not so controversial in some areas, and they are really shared in terms of the long-term benefit. In this context, and given that I think that the political reality is this one, then I say if I have to choose policies, I would choose a couple of policies that are kind of potential to bring a strong effect, but not so controversial, and so where we can find an agreement going forward. And the two policies are, I can rephrase the first one and say policies for productivity that also pass through investment. So I align with Daniel. And the second one is working on financial market integration. So on the first one, I really think about working for productivity, so everything that is structural reform, etc., but being very, very serious on that. Investment, and investment potentially also with investment generated at the European level and with some sort of redistribution according to at the European level. And even the whole discussion of having fiscal stabilizer or fiscal capacity at the European level that could pass also via investment and maybe work in case of asymmetric shock, I think is an important discussion that we are also having in this moment. And then going to the financial market integration. Sorry, going to the financial market integration. I think it's a very important point because we are moving in terms of a banking union and we are moving in terms of capital market union. Somehow I have the impression that entering into the detail of the reforms, particularly in capital market union, we lose the big picture. And the big picture actually comes from a very, very nice report from the CEPS, from Valiente, that is really going back and looking like we have a banking union, we have a capital market union, but really what we want is capital flows intra-EU, and we want to see private sector flows going intra-EU. And that comes out from having a real banking union, a real capital market union, where you're not afraid of having investments going from Germany to Italy, as was happening through the crisis. And I think this is where we have to work. And somehow, in some cases, I've seen plans in the name of Capital Market Union that actually were going toward creating a local domestic equity market for local firms, etc., that goes against this principle of cross-border flow that should be the base for the financial sector integration.
Thank you very much. Would the panelists like to comment what their co-panelists have said? Daniel.
I'll just ask, okay, we say in the past we just talked about integration, reforms, and education. Now we're going to be serious. What objective element makes us certain that this time will be serious?
Yes, I think this was a really important question. So what I have heard, I have a few questions after what you've said. Laszlo, you said that the euro needs a narrative, and I couldn't agree more. If you connect this with Daniel's question, would a narrative for the euro make that things are going better this time?
I think this question should go to Daniel.
Just tell us what you're missing.
No, but, I couldn't give a guarantee on this. From this seat. So we saw in 2012 the four presidents' report and 15 the five presidents' report. So if it goes like this, in 18 we have the six presidents' report and supposedly the series would go like this. It will not. I think the point is, which a lot of people can't see, that Europe cannot afford a lost decade like Japan did in the 1990s because the system is a lot more fragile. If we have the ECB with a kind of implicit authorization, of course, it's not so fragile financially, but it's still very fragile politically. And that's what is a lot more difficult to control. And people should not believe that various democratic forces across a variety of EU member states would just wait until the six presidents' report and the seven presidents' report. So As compared to the urgency, in my view, the work in this area is just too slow. Bratislava was mentioned. And indeed, there is one way of reading the Bratislava phenomenon, that after Brexit, we will have a tendency to go back to the lowest common denominator. I'm sure this problem cannot be resolved if we just go all the time for the lowest common denominator. So someone needs to be brave.
You didn't hear that. Will somebody take over or start the debate? We don't know yet. Yeah, well, what I conclude is that things might get better if we really started to talk about what keeps us together at the political level and not only at the economic level. Talking about maybe improving things by integrating financial markets, I would like to ask you, what do you think of the strategy of the European Commission to promote the non-bank credit market? So to promote institutions that are not banks, that are not under banking regulation, but might do a lot of good to providing credit for industry. Do you think that this might improve things and that might maybe solve the problem that industry always complains about not having enough access to credit?
Well, I did mention that in my introductory remarks. So I do think that it's important. A couple of things, though. So first of all, I think you cannot think of these things as being not correlated. So you know, banks are extremely important for the operation of financial markets. If we have banks that are, you know, deeply loaded with non-performing loans, and if we have banks that are over-regulated and you know, they are not going to be effective players in the capital markets either. But I, as I said, I really think we need a much better balance between markets and banks in providing finance to firms, and you know, ultimately, you know, it is about promoting productivity. So I think no one here, you know, questions that, and I think that's what this panel is about. But you know, if I see what's holding back productivity in the short and medium term, I think a lot of the answers are in the financial sector, unfortunately.
Thank you. Nauro Campos, you have talked about integration and the benefit of integration and the declining probability that integration will really be realized. So what is your indicator? When would you say that integration has happened, and what kind of integration do you think is positive? Are there also negative aspects of integration?
Thank you. I mean, in all three cases that I mentioned, we use quite different metrics. I think that one important additional element here is to consider DMU and how does integration play a role in that. And in this context, I would even like to do a... was looking at intereconomics, the first issue of this year, has a wonderful article by Otomar Ising that is very aptly titled On the Relation Between Monetary and Political Union. And I think that starting to think and talk about this very delicate relationship is necessary. In terms of indicators of that, I mean, we have done some work in terms of trying to devise a simple theory-driven indicator of corners. I mean, this conference, we saw a number of different papers talking about core periphery, and it's quite well established. I mean, easy way of looking at these imbalances, right? But we still lack robust, I mean, time-varying indicator, and we have trying of late to develop that. And one of the, I mean, there are a number of the main outcome of this metrics, as you mentioned, is that there are quite a few surprises. I mean, we find, just to give an idea, we found, first of all, I mean, Deborah will be very happy to hear, I mean, we find that Italy, I mean, it doesn't matter what you do to the indicator score. Then we have identified empirically three main groups. And there are good news and bad news. One of the most terrifying bad news is that we have a periphery that over time is deep-seated, that does not move, does not change clubs. And there we have countries, I mean, we just did it for the U15. We have countries like Portugal and Finland, in which, I mean, our indicator of coreness, which is the inverse of peripherickness, I presume, is very, very high for those countries. The core, I mean, what we observe in the core, I mean, since the beginning of the EMU project, is not only that there is a core of countries, but that those group, that those countries become much more integrated. I mean, with the very steep trajectory of this core group. Not only they were core 20 years ago, but they are much more core now by our measure. And a third of the countries, it's this mixed case. I mean, it's a very interesting mix of experiences in which you have, for example, Sweden, which becomes over between 1990 and 2015, much less core, I mean, according to our measure. Spain slowly becomes more core, and you have illustration of a third potential type of trajectory is the UK, that gradually enters the core club all the way to the crisis and then abruptly leaves. There are ways of thinking about these issues, and I think the more we are kind of transparent, replicable in trying to carry out these exercises. The better understanding we'll have of what exactly integration means and how politics, the political aspect of it and the monetary aspect of it are related.
Can you relate this to the growth topic, to the question that Daniel has asked, what will be better if we integrate more in terms of promoting growth?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we do observe that the core, has a much more sustainable, the correlation, of course, right? I mean, I'm not claiming causality there, but, I mean, the core countries have a much more steady patterns of growth than the other two groups, actually.
I would like to respond to Daniel by challenging the hypothesis that all depends on productivity. I know this is risky because it's so obvious. But we have also observed in the past that competitiveness may not be as dependent on labor productivity as on innovativeness. And what we read about Industry 4.0, the new wave of technological development, we hear that the essential thing is to innovate in terms of new products that are more competitive on the international markets, on integration of value chains. So it's more a qualitative question, and we cannot even compare the productivity levels between the old products and the new products. The essential thing is to come and win over markets with innovative ideas and with creativity.
Yeah, I agree, but actually if I look at the numbers, I would say in terms of competitiveness, let me measure it by the share of EU exporters on the global markets for manufacturers. The EU is doing fine. Its share of global exports of manufacturers has actually remained constant over the last 20 years. That of the US and Japan has gone down, and of course China's has rocketed. So I would say in terms of external competitiveness, we are doing fine. It's the internal one, the productivity, which has been gone from bad to worse. absolutely speaking and relative to a comparator like the United States. And that's what needs explaining, given all the efforts we have done, at least with the mouth. And that's why I don't see the recipe for change.
How much does this have to do with the decline of the manufacturing sector as against the services sector? Because in services, it's really difficult to say something of the development of productivity. And in many cases, we also had just completely new services where you can't say very much about productivity.
That is true, what you just said. But as I said, our productivity performance compared to the United States. And the U.S., the service sector is even larger. So this mismanagement should be an advantage for Europe. And there might be a generalized mismeasurement of growth. But as I said, if you compare us to the U.S., then you take that one out. And the facts are still that we have gone down.
Thank you. A last question to Deborah. As many others, you talk about the integration of financial markets. What does it mean for a European financial market that the UK is not with us anymore?
Sounded very morbid. No. I was.
I imagine the facet. It's too big of a question. I think because in this moment we really have no clue of how the whole process will develop, etc. At least I wouldn't know what is sensible to say in terms of the answer. If I can turn a little bit at the question, my point is more. It's more to look at what needs, what do we need in the rest, let's assume Brexit, financial sector, etc. What do we need in the rest of the financial sector, of the European financial market to develop? And the policy is more for the rest of Europe. And I think for the rest of Europe, one of the issues that we will ever more and more going forward is that we have these policies, particularly banking union, etc., are euro area based, and capital market union is EU market based. So we end up having two different perimeters. While the final objective, and I will going back to what I was saying, the final objective is to guarantee that we have an integrated financial sector, whatever the means is. So is it capital market, is it bond market, is it bank financing, etc., where resources flow from one country to the other and there is a movement of capital in this point of view. And we will have more and more a market where you have an EU market, then Brexit in, out, or whatever, and then you have a banking market where the integration is at the euro area level and the coordination will be difficult. And that is a process where I think discussing Brexit, we still have to have it under control. And I think Eric and myself, we worked a lot in the past on one initiative that is called the Vienna Initiative, that was how to guarantee that the financial market of Central Eastern Europe remains integrated in Europe. Already in the last years, we had, before Brexit, before everything, we had a lot of issues of really mediating. Just as institution, we were bringing to the ECB, to the SSM, the point of view of some of the smaller central bankers that didn't have that much access to the dialogue. Already now, in the market as it is now. And more this coordination will be particularly important for the EU euro area element.
Oh, like my comment was more in the jocular. I mean, in the sense that you said the country is no longer with us, and I have a flight to go back to. So I maybe just see, you know, I saw it sinking somewhere. But seriously, so I think you know, looking at this from a UK perspective, it's not going well. I mean, so you know, there are. things happening on the UK side and things happening on the other side. Of course, some of this is posturing, but I think some of the statements that have been made by Theresa May on last weekend or the 1 week ago really points to a hard Brexit, and clearly UK being outside the single market. To me, this is, if you talk about financial integration, I think Europe as a whole will be a loser from this, because it's not, I don't, some activities will probably go to Europe, but most will go to New York. So I think, and so I think there is some very big issues at stake.
Let's just go for a moment back to our core question: what is wrong with our growth policies? If I think about what is happening at the moment at the national level and at the EU level, it looks very much like more of the same. So we are trying to solve the problems with instruments that haven't worked in the past, and why do we think they will work in the future? So my question is to all of you, do we have to change instruments? Do we have to go back and think more clearly about what went wrong? Why do these instruments not take effect? So do you have any ideas about what went wrong with the EU strategy so far? Anders, volunteer.
Yes, I have. I was responsible for some instruments which can be discussed in this discussion under this particular question. And this is, for example, the case of the EU funds. The European Union has a significant budget. In my view, it's smaller than it should be. In my view, the Eurozone itself should also have fiscal capacity. But we do have funds. These are not tiny. And I think the experience shows that some of these funds could be used with much better efficiency in order to promote gross productivity and help growth to be sustainable in countries which are doing well, and help growth to start newly in countries which have been in recession or stagnation. And if I emphasized in the first round that the monetary union should be kind of reconsidered and some innovation is needed, Daniel's consortium was, for example, delivering a fantastic study on automatic stabilizers. That's also another idea. But I would like to stress in another context, in the context of the EU funds, that while, of course, we appreciate what has been happening so far, but there is a lot we could somehow reinvent in this area. And even more provocatively, I could say that, you know, in the last 30 years, there was a lot, perhaps too much financial innovation in the private sector, but not enough in the public sector, including the budget of the European Union. So some innovation began with financial engineering and changing the approach, you know, not giving everything as a grant financing, for example, for regional development. But in fact, Eric's presentation in the afternoon brought up something very interesting, which is the need to connect innovative financial instruments with an industrial policy. And with that, we could indeed refresh, you know, some parts of our economy. And this is also needed, in my view, where seemingly things are going very well. We all referred, for example, to the cohesion countries or Eastern Europe or the new member states, that all growth rates are much better than in the Eurozone. This is true. But this is based on a particular use of financial instruments of the EU budget, which is not going to be there all the time, and which will, you know, run its time, and then new ways would need to be invented in order to maintain a convergent growth rate. So also for these countries to put more into human capital, to put more into social investment, to put more and better in skills development, and match it with the needs of industry and investment opportunities, I think this is something where we should look for new ways and new ideas.
Daniel?
Maybe I'll make a comment on financial markets. And I will be speaking partially under the control of Martin Helwig. I want to make 2 points. A, the first point I think we have learned from the run-up to the crisis is that more financial market activity is not always better. And therefore, if the UK leaves and we have a little bit less of financial market activity, is that such a bad thing? Right? Can we actually point to concrete channels through which growth would be heard? And the second point is to make a reference to Germany and the way I interpret a big financial reform, which was when Mario Monti took away the state guarantee for the Sparkassen system, which in my interpretation here, I'm speaking under your control, led to a sort of mini credit crunch in Germany. And what I observe from the aggregate data is that the investment rate in Germany went down, but the marginal productivity of investment went up a lot. And that is why I think Germany was relatively well-placed during the financial crisis, and why Italy is so badly based, because they had a lot of investment, but it went to a very inefficient banking system, and a lot of it was wasted, and you see it today in the both low growth and the high NPL ratios. So my final thing is, maybe we shouldn't always think, how can we get more investment, but how can we actually have a financial system which is tougher in the selection of investment processes and delivers higher productivity of capital?
I think this is a good question to give back to the audience. So even if you cannot answer this question, maybe Martin Helwig wants to comment. So you can raise your hand and make a comment or ask a question, even if you cannot answer the questions we have posed here. So I would like to encourage you to say what you still have to say after all these comments.
Yes, I have followed this gospel on investment for a long time, and I'm going to publish a book on a report we did for the Hans Böckler Foundation on growth and investment. But what always puzzles me is, first, what you point out, efficiency of investment matters. From a microeconomic point of view, it's a return of investment which matters. From a macroeconomic point, it's the volume of investment which is always under debate. And it's an implicit assumption that there is markets are efficient allocation mechanisms for investments. But we know from Hayek on that there are malinvestment, that financial markets are inefficient in a certain direction, that they allocate resources into the wrong investment projects. And this finally leads to a dilemma, which you pointed out, Daniel Gross. Even if you reduce investment, the efficiency increases. If you invest more, efficiency decreases. And the same would be the case if you would arbitrarily increase investment in infrastructure. You could build, like in Japan, bridges to nowhere, or invest in huge infrastructure projects which finally don't pay off. Many developing countries have done have had this experience, building roads to nowhere, or irrigation systems which finally didn't work. So the linkage between the micro level of efficient investment and macroeconomic sufficient investment into those projects which really pay off, this is an unsolved problem. And we cannot solve it on the macro level because we have not underpinning to guarantee that the resources are invested properly and markets are not a guarantee for efficient investment. That's the whole dilemma.
We have a response by the world.
I think I fully agree that you have to have a good assessment of the quality of projects, and you can have policies that are designed where you have an ex-ante assessment of the quality of the project, economic rate of return, etc. Like the EIB works in this way. We are a public institution, we are financing investment projects at the European level. A project that comes to us is scrutinized, and we say no to a number of projects. Then maybe we have political issues, pressures, etc. But if we don't believe in a project, there is a quality control. And I think this is particularly important, and is partly, I was in one of the parallel sessions before, but one of the things that I was saying, an institution like the EIB that is issuing bonds on the market, has its own capital of the 28 member states, etc., and can invest all over Europe and doesn't have invest on projects, and they have to be good projects. So there is no predefined key of how much you have to invest in one country or the other. There are some trends, but there is nothing predefined. And you have to find a good project, etc. This is an instrument to, if you want, also redistribute. I know that in Germany it's not so popular, but to redistribute at the benefit of European investment, where you have a good project wherever, independently on the geographical location. And it's partly a way to go on the final fragmentation of the financial market that we see now, but it's very small. At the end of the EIB is an 80 billion lending per year, so it's small for the European economy, but it's an element. But I fully agree with you on the quality of the project.
Okay, thank you very much. Martin Helwig.
I want to raise an issue of governance. When we talk about Europe or we talk about new growth for Europe, who are we talking about? And the specific issue, I mean, if we talk about the European Investment Bank, that's a small part of the system, and we really need to talk about the system as a whole. And there I see a fundamental tension between having national governments, national fiscal authorities, a European Central Bank, and fragmented monetary systems with banks that are now under European supervision, but effectively, as shown by the Greek or the Spanish experience, dependent on the policies of their national governments, and the national governments don't want to let go of their control over these banks.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid time is over, but I would like to give the panelists an opportunity to say a last concluding sentence. Eric, would you like to start?
Well, I think what Professor Helwig was saying here, I think, is absolutely key. And you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like we're arguing that more investment is good for its own sake, or that the sort of the modern productivity of investment doesn't matter. But if we have a system that is so dysfunctional in terms of the connection between the supervision of banks, the regulation of banks, the resolution of banks, and where the responsibilities for policies of national governments are not integrated. So we need to find a way where there's a reasonable risk burden sharing that leads to a financial system that is more likely to produce good investments. Again, you know, it's not about expanding the financial system for its own sake. It's about having a healthy financial system. I think you gave a very good example of how, you know, by you know, some sort of dysfunctional parts of the German system was limited, and in that way, actually the overall productivity or the overall function of the system was improved. I think there's still a lot to do in Germany in that regard. But
one more sentence.
Just a sentence. And I think I fully share the view that one of the sad stories and one thing we should work on post-crisis is why don't we have anymore or the very few are very unhappy to be cross-border bank intra-Europe. And I think that the result of the...
You turned it off on...
The result of the overall crisis is that we end up having really the cross-border banking model to be completely affected and disrupted, whoever can is retrenching. And now you start seeing, and I think I start seeing particularly from French central bank, French bankers that are probably the strong bank in this moment, the strongest bank in Europe, and they have less margin for domestic consolidation. They start saying you have to do something, because I think they start thinking we would like to start moving, but please make the condition right. Please make the condition right on the capital point of view, buffers, whatever, etc., for us to move.
Thank you. Now, what is your concluding remark?
I just would like to add, I mean, I think that the financial system is crucially important, but maybe a lesson from Robert Gordon and all the supply side recent research on this gap between the US and the EU is in terms of revisiting one action that maybe we didn't do very well the last 10 or 15 years, is the different take-up. I mean, if you look at ICT diffusion, I mean, diffusion of information and communication technologies, I mean, what this literature, this stylized fact that this literature deals with is essentially that in the U.S., I mean, the diffusion was very rapidly, but in the take-up in the private sector. I mean, the speed of diffusion is not very different from Europe, but it's mostly in the public sector. There are lots of computers in the public sector in Europe, and not a lot in the private sector, and the very opposite picture in the U.S. And maybe, I mean, if the financial sector can help strike a better balance, would be a good, if we can redo the past, that would be a good thing to do, probably.
Yeah, I think what Martin Helwig pointed out is crucial, but it's not something, this tension between national authorities and EU authorities cannot be resolved. That's part of our structure. It works best when we create federal institutions to take care of a very specific issue, like the ECB for monetary policy, like the ECB SSM for banking supervision, hopefully the SRM for resolution. So on the banking system, I'm not so pessimistic. I think the direction is right. And what we need, however, is a very strong commission, as the example of Mario Monti showed, on competition policy, on state aids, enforcing the common rules. These are things we can do within the present institutional framework. Unfortunately, whatever the Five Presidents' report say, I'm very skeptical that anything will actually come out in things that would change radically this tension which we have to live with.
I agree with the need for a strong commission, of course, which means that sometimes you have to deliver things which are not necessarily fashionable, but you believe in that and you know that it will produce a result with time. To give you an example, I believe that social investment policies are very important and Europe should focus more on human capital, also for the sake of long-term growth. We heard it from Professor Hemerijk today that much of these policies do not produce overnight results. But what has been launched in the recent period, for example, on youth employment, on Roma integration, against child poverty, These policies need to be continued and funded adequately from the European Union resources, because otherwise, here and there, even if the banking sector gets consolidated, even if we have developing capital markets, the fundamentals of economic growth, which is human capital at the end of the day, will shrink. And Europe will lose when we could actually win in many, many areas. So this is what I would like to stress.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all panelists for joining us today. Thank you very much for an interesting discussion and many important remarks. I would like to invite you to go to our reception now. It's downstairs where all the breaks were. And you can stay there with us and continue discussions. I do hope that today we have not left only open questions, but many edges from which you can get a new view on these open questions. Thank you very much.